Good evening, Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web. Well, obviously, the story of the day, the foiled bombing attack in Britain. This has a particular resonance for us here in Canada, and particularly in Quebec, and it should have a particular resonance, coming off a weekend where we had a march for peace that had as many Hezbollah flags as Lebanese flags, that had vicious rhetoric. Somehow this march for peace for Lebanon and Palestine decided to exclude Israel. Peace, apparently, is morally relative. We better get it. Why is there only this cosmic sense of justice in Canada available when it concerns Israel? This isn't Israel's war. It's all our wars. These people mean us harm, whether they're on the battlefield like Hezbollah, paramilitary, using babies and old women as human shields, or whether they're just the strangers among us who refuse to accept Western liberal pluralism. It's a war that's going to continue unless we get it. And I was asked by Mike Dean earlier, but security, and as much as security is important, what's important is the consciousness of all free peoples. If national attitudes change, these people go to ground. They're like night crawlers. If we maintain a moral relativism about everybody's right to be wrong, they're going to be there, they're going to keep bombing, they're going to keep shelling, and they're going to keep killing. We have this strange, weird attitude in the West. You know, we put out all our dirty laundry for everybody to see, and we pound our chests in sorrow at things like Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib was not an atrocity. Cutting off people's heads is an atrocity. Blowing up 12 airliners is an atrocity. Killing young Muslim girls because they're going to Christian schools are atrocities. Beheading Muslim women because they're sleeping with a man who's not their husband is an atrocity. Killing gays is an atrocity. There is no moral relativism. Where was this cosmic sense of injustice? When Sunnis kill Shiites who kill other Sunnis and all of them kill Americans and the world is silent. Where is this cosmic sense of justice? When the Russia destroyed entire villages and burned down large cities in order to repress the revolt in Chechnya. When NATO bombed Kosovo for 3 months and crushed the civilian population. And all these places had uprising from radical Islam. Now we know that radical Islam represent 10, 20% perhaps of the world Muslim population. We need to be vigilant against that philosophy. We need to be vigilant for our own freedom. That's what's going to put these people to the ground. Our first two stories tonight, we're going to take a look at this particular sad day from two perspectives. One, from the security perspective of what kind of damage these bombs can do. And our guest will be David Harrell, who is former head of the Israel Security Agency's International Affairs Division and with a specialty in aviation security. He's now with ASERO Worldwide Security. And from London, we're going to be talking with Colonel Peter Reynolds, formerly with the United Nations force that oversaw the Iraqi elections. He was also NATO's public affairs director about what the situation is on the ground in London, where 185,000 people have been stranded at Heathrow. And we'll be right back with David Harrell after this. Or email us at info@iapm.ca. On a day when the other fronts of radical Islam have taken the headlines, massive foiled bombing plot in London that would have brought down 12 planes, Air Canada jets, not flying down to Washington, we understand that this is not just Israel's struggle. Israel is merely the front-line nation in the family of free nations. Radical Islam is a threat to all free peoples. But to get a perspective on how much damage these guys could have done, it's our pleasure to welcome David Harrell from Israel, who was formerly the head of the International Division of the Israel Security Agency and is now with ASERO Worldwide Security. And David's particular specialty was in aviation security. David, thank you very much for joining us. You have a unique perspective and expertise, and I know it's late in Israel. How are you?
Thank you, Bill. Nice talking to you again.
What is this concentration on liquids? What were these guys planning?
Well, the use of liquid explosives in terrorist attacks against aviation is nothing new. We've seen them in a bomb attack, which a foiled attack on LAL Airlines in 1986 in Madrid. We saw it again in the bombing of Air Korea flight in 1987 by the North Korean intelligence agencies. We saw liquid explosives again in use in the Bojinka plan in 1995. So it's just another form of explosives, one of many, one of hundreds, in fact, and one which is very easy to conceal in the aviation arena.
When we're talking liquids, what is the chemical compound? What's the chemical composition that they use, and how do they hide it? Clear liquids, gels. What were the security force looking for?
There's many types. There are all different types. It can look like clear, like water. It can be thick. It can be gel. This is a part of the explanation why there was such a almost, I'd say, panic today in the aviation security domain.
Is this going to be now something that's going to become a standard, like taking away cigar cutters and nail clippers?
Well, it might be for the near future until the security organizations adjust themselves and start working out other measures which may bridge the gap between the current technologies and current threats.
Is this how common was this when you were in government security work? Was this the kind of thing that would be checked regularly at airports, whether it is in Israel or abroad?
Bombings in the aviation world have not been in the last few years too common, but the threats have been, we have all been aware of the threats certainly since 9/11 and even before then. So in the high-risk airline security business, we've been well aware of the threats of this nature and been dealing with them, in fact.
David, we're going to come back to you right after we pay some bills, and we're going to have a little talk and a little look at what the situation on the ground in Israel is today. We'll be right back once after this. And we're talking about today's foiled bomb plot in London. Special guest David Harel from Israel, former head of the International Division of the Israel Security Agency, special expertise in aviation securities. David, let me ask you, there's been some concern that this situation will now raise the question again of the need for profiling. How much in security work really is profiling, and how much is really hard intelligence?
Hard intelligence is what we saw, the success today by the British authorities, which need to be congratulated. That's intelligence. You need intelligence to understand the threats as well, which is vital for aviation security companies. But it's not intelligence that's involved here. This is it's security levels. And unfortunately today, current security levels, aviation security levels, are not up to the current threats. And one of the ways of trying to bridge that gap is by using profiling, which in some places is called a dirty word. It's considered a dirty word, but unfortunately it might be one of the only reasonable weapons that can be used if we're not going to have to see the kind of chaos we saw at airports today.
It's not just the chaos of the airports, but ironically, if we're not going to see the compromise of civil liberties, then maybe that's one of the few ways that we've got to try to figure this out when they've got homegrown terrorists. If something's visible, how can you not allow a security person or security personnel to ask questions?
I couldn't agree with you more. I think you have to use technology, but you have to combine it with some kind of system which uses indicators, threat indicators. I'm not saying that all Muslim communities have to be profiled. Profiling doesn't have to be on race. Profiling should be on behavior, on intelligence, and profiling can be very successful and help you focus your efforts where they need to be, because we can see from today that technology at present doesn't give us the whole solution.
David, one final question before we let you go to sleep at 1 o'clock in the morning. I know it's a rough time in Israel.
2 o'clock.
Even worse. This kind of an incident, you think it'll make people, particularly in Western Europe, understand that Israel's fight with Hezbollah is not Israel versus Hezbollah. It's Hezbollah in Israel. It's other groups in other countries. It's an attack on the West. Israel is just a frontline nation in the family of free nations. Does this kind of a thing get more understanding for what's going on in the Middle East right now?
I hope so, but you know, when you're watching some of the shows on TV, you're already hearing people saying that blaming these incidents or this attempts on possibly what's been going on in Lebanon, yet we hear it's been being planned for months in advance, nothing to do with Lebanon at all. So,
and we had it in Toronto here, 14 months, 17 people arrested, where we had CSIS and the RCMP actually go to the families of these alleged terrorists, be careful with my language, in Toronto, and ask them to stop.
Don't forget 9/11 as well. They accused Israel of being one of the motivating forces for 9/11. When you look at it, you look back, and you see that 9/11 was being planned for close to 2 years, which takes you up to the process when at the successful height of the peace process, before the peace process broke down, when everything was looking good. So it's just an excuse. Israel is not really the motivator here. It's an excuse for these extremists who I think they will do it whether Israel was here or not.
It's stunning. It truly is stunning that when we think that the last seven times that the state sent their young men out, it was to protect Muslims in places like Kosovo. Russia had to put down revolts in Chechnya in horrible fashion. NATO bombed civilian populations, and there was no cosmic sense of injustice. It only seems to come out when Israel's protecting itself. And that hypocrisy, as Victor Davis Hanson said in the show last night, is the new spirit of appeasement, and God help us if it continues. David Harrell in Israel, good luck to you, and thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Will. Good night.
Good night. From Israel, we go to London. And before I introduce our next guest, just want to read to you what he emailed to me today. Stuff the rally for peace. I'm living in a country which has been cut off from the rest of the world aeronautically, a country where catching a flight has become even more of a lottery. That doesn't come from just anybody. That comes from retired British Army Colonel Peter Reynolds, who was NATO's public affairs director, who was an advisor to the United Nations team overseeing the Iraqi elections. And we want to get a feeling for what's it like in London tonight. And Peter Reynolds, thank you for staying up late to be with us.
No problem, Beryl.
How many people stuck at Heathrow?
People affected, and I've just been watching the BBC 24-hour news headlines, is allegedly up to 500,000. Although 180,000 passengers throughout the UK didn't go to that many places.
Even 180,000 is a lot. You know, Tony Blair's been getting a lot of heat for his support for Israel's position in the war, his support of America's position. Is an incident like this make Britons understand that this is not just a war of Israel and Hezbollah, that this is throughout the West and a danger throughout the West?
Now, the excuse I heard used tonight on some of the interview shows that were on the TV here was that it's disaffected British Muslim youth who are unhappy with Britain's foreign policy in general.
We just have to take a short break, Peter, but when we come back, I want to discuss where those disaffected people were when other Muslim populations were being bombed by people other than NATO. Montreal will be right back after this. Or email at us at info@iapm.ca, and we want to hear from you whether this incident today, the foiled bombing plot, has it gotten through to everybody again, as if we needed a reminder, that this is a war around the world, that we're in a global war. This isn't just Israel and Hezbollah. With us is Colonel Peter Reynolds, retired British Army colonel, former head of public affairs for NATO, and former advisor to the UN team that oversaw the Iraq elections. Peter, you were mentioning the atmosphere in Britain. I had asked you, Blair being under attack for being very much with President Bush, very much with the Americans, whether this incident has gotten through to Britain's that it's not just an isolated problem.
I suspect it probably has. But, I mean, Tony Blair has been under some pressure from within his own party for some time now, although he's managed to hold it all together extremely well in very trying circumstances, especially after the police on the last couple of occasions appear to have aimed at the wrong targets. However, today's successful interception will have done not only security forces serious good, but also may have reinforced his position, his strong position.
You mentioned before the break that you were hearing talk show hosts or chattering classes on the talk shows or commentators discussing attitudes of people who feel that this is a manifestation of some British Muslims' disenchantment with Britain's foreign policy. But are the people on the ground beginning to understand that it's time to say, hey, we don't really care what you like or don't like about Britain's foreign policy. We don't like the way you manifest your disapproval. So either do it our way or there are consequences. Is there any of that chattering going on? Is there any of that anger going on?
I mean, 2 points to make on that. It is a seriously small minority who are young, disaffected, and have become so radicalized by what they have been taught and heard in those particular religious communities or by those, you know, have been taught by those zealots. I mean, it's a very small number. The majority of the Muslim population in this country is here to work and to bring up their families and do all those other things. Now, the second point is that, yes, I presume it will, if this is proved to have been a coherent plot, and that once these people have been interviewed over the next 28 days, which is what the police have got, and that the police will gather the evidence to sustain a successful conviction, then I think more people will take notice and will say, well, we don't care that you're disaffected. You know, just get on with life and live your life, but live it in a democratic way.
Why should anybody care whether they're disaffected? There are ways to show disaffection in a
democracy. There's a youthful disaffection, which is going through not just the Muslim, but there are reasons of unemployment and all those other things of being in not particularly privileged, living in particularly privileged areas where work is difficult to find.
Yes, but the last seven times that Britain had to put the best of its young people on the line was to protect Muslims, and every time the radical Muslims get disaffected, they make a plot to blow up airplanes or they blow up subway planes, trains in London. Isn't there a time to call a halt to it at one point? Like, we're not listening anymore.
Well, I can't help but agree with you slightly, but to take those slightly harsher steps is outside the British psyche as it is at the moment, I believe.
Is the British psyche, as Victor Davis Hanson wrote yesterday, moral insanity? To put it in his words, it once seemed surreal to reread the fantasies of Chamberlain, but no longer?
Well, probably not. I think this particular plot, which has caused, as you have so more than adequately noted, a great deal of disruption. Lufthansa have cancelled their flights to Heathrow for the foreseeable future. So
they're not cut up yet in England, are they?
Huh?
They're not cut up yet in Great Britain, are they?
No.
This is going to take some while to sort out.
It'll take another 3-4 days or so for flights to get back on schedule. I mean, it will become much clearer in the next 24, 36 hours. Ask me again in 36 hours' time, and I'll give you a proper perspective.
Peter Reynolds, before I let you go and get some well-earned rest, you have a unique perspective around the world. You've been in all the hot trouble spots. You were in the Balkans. You commanded a battle group in the Balkans. Are we at a time where the mere suggestion that there's any pattern to global terrorism constitutes the profferor of that position as being an Islamophobic, and therefore we have to take every single individual case and dissect it down to its lowest common denominator and talk about disaffected youth instead of calling it as it is, that this may well be, and by many intelligence reports, is well-planned out cells. One may not know what the other's doing, but arriving from a central point.
There are suggestions that today's arrests were in fact to some extent linked to the arrests that took place in Karachi about 4 days ago, where a similar group of people were arrested who had direct contact with Al-Qaeda leaders who are hiding out in Pakistan. Now, I personally am against Islamophobia in all its forms. What I am seriously in favor of is dealing with terrorism on its merits.
Nobody's advocating Islamophobia, but any commentator that seems to say that there's a pattern to this, to Madrid and Beslan and Bali and London, is all of a sudden labeled with that. But I think, is it not legitimate to suggest that, hey, you know, these aren't just individual events popping up all over the place?
No, they are obviously, they have some religious basis. Now, but we should be careful, in my estimation, of condemning the whole of Islam, the whole of the real Islam, because what is currently being preached to you, these young people, is, in my estimation, a perversion of that religion, of the real religion, out of condemning it wholesale. I much prefer to deal with terrorism on its own merits and dismerits, and in order to beat the terrorist, you have to be as sneaky as he is.
Sneakier.
More sneaky, absolutely.
Peter Reynolds, have a good night's rest. Hopefully tomorrow will be better in London. Thanks for joining us.
Great evening yourself.
Take care. Montreal, be right back. You know, we've been talking about today's foiled bomb plot. We've been talking about the problem of radical Islam. But I think it's important to underline one thing. In this war, and it is a global war, we can't mirror what we're seeking to destroy. We can't forget that the reason we send the best of our youth into harm's way is to protect the very civil liberties that we cherish as Canadians. You heard David Harrell say earlier, it's not categories or profiling that's going to do the job. It's hard intelligence. You look at people's behavior. There's an extraordinary story of a Canadian citizen named Hussein Salil who had gone to Uzbekistan to see his wife's family and was arrested, spent months in jail, wasn't allowed a letter from his wife, who then came back to Canada. He was arrested when he was renewing his visa, and Uzbekistan turned him over to China because Mr. Salil belongs to, is an ethnic Uyghur of Muslim faith, and there are 7 million in China who have been fighting for independence, 7.2 million Turkic-speaking Muslims, and China's not really interested in recognizing anybody's claims for independence. They're interested in Hong Kong and Taiwan and everything else, and Hussein Salil has been sentenced to death, and our government has a big problem trying to get him out, and we're happy to have with us Gloria Nassiger from Amnesty International, who's been doing the heavy lifting on this file. Gloria, thank you very much for being with us. I wish it was under happier circumstances.
Yes, indeed.
This is an extraordinary case. First of all, what happened in Uzbekistan when he was trying to renew his visa? Why?
Well, yeah, that's a mystery to everyone.
Why wasn't he offered Canadian protection at that point?
Well, in fact, when he was in Uzbekistan, the Canadian authorities did immediately try to seek him out, and they were allowed consular visits while he was in Uzbekistan. And they certainly, at that point, were very involved in terms of encouraging the Uzbek authorities not to extradite him to China, as had been requested, and they were active in trying to seek his release and have him returned to Canada at that point in time. But to no avail, obviously, he was extradited to China, and that happened without the knowledge of the Canadian authorities at the time.
On what grounds was he explained.
Well, yeah, I mean, and what he's being charged with is, it's very vague, it's not at all clear. There's allegations that he's involved in so-called terrorist activities, although nothing has been very specific about what that might be. Mr. Jalil came to Canada originally as a refugee. He had previously been imprisoned in China because he was trying to form a political party. Certainly nothing that comes anywhere close to what anyone would understand to be terrorist type of activity. And that's the really sad beginning, is that basic human rights to, you know, freedom of expression are violated in China, and he's a victim of that.
What can Canada do with China? I mean, here's a country that, by certain estimates, Human Rights Watch and others, have killed 20,000 political prisoners last year. What can Canada do? What can Canadians do to force Canada to act? And where is Hussein Salil's case now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what Amnesty International is calling for now is for Stephen Harper to be very active and to communicate with the Chinese authorities. I think there have been diplomatic efforts that have been going on in his behalf, but to no avail, and it's time for Stephen Harper to be personally involved at the highest level with Chinese authorities, expressing our concern for Mr. Jilil's well-being, but as a Canadian citizen, he must be given Canadian consular access, and it's time for Stephen Harper to be directly involved in that.
Where can Canadians reach out, reach you, reach Amnesty International to help? Should they write directly to their MPs as well, of course?
Well, there is an action on Amnesty International's website directly relating to Mr. Jilil. There are a number of requests that we're asking of the Chinese government, and that action is available on Amnesty International's website.
Which is Amnesty International?
www.amnesty.ca. That's the Canadian website.
Just .amnesty.ca?
Yep, that's it. And it's on the front page of that website, and anyone who is concerned about this can go and will find that action right on the front of page of the website, and they can write a letter immediately.
Gloria, I just got to pay some bills. I want to come back with you and ask you a last question about what your next steps are.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. We're back. We're talking with Gloria Nafziger of Amnesty International from Toronto about the terrible case of Hussein Salil, a Canadian citizen, sitting in jail in China for basically trying to organize for minority rights in that country at one point. And he was extradited from Uzbekistan, where he was on a visit to China, and Canada was powerless to stop him. Gloria, this is obviously shades of the Maher Arar case. Where does Amnesty go from here?
Well, I think Amnesty will continue to advocate to the Chinese authorities and to the Canadian government to protect his basic rights. And we have been following this file for already the last 4 months, and we'll continue to press the Chinese government to ensure that he is given Canadian access to consular officials, and also that he can be released from detention, most importantly.
Is there talk of an execution date? Is that...
There had been the information his family in China received suggested that he could have been executed as early as today. Yesterday, significantly, the Chinese government spoke publicly about the case for the first time and indicated that his case is now being handled according to law, and that no verdict has yet been reached. But that's very disturbing, because it's still impossible to know. Nobody knows how his case is being handled, what the law is, what he's being charged with. He hasn't been given access to a lawyer. There are so many ways in which his rights have been violated that it's very difficult to take much confidence in the assurance that his case is being handled appropriately when so much remains unknown.
Well, this is certainly something that Canadians should have to get involved in, and if it wasn't for organizations like Amnesty, you know, people would be in a lot of trouble in a lot of places in the world. And www.amnesty.ca, go to the website, get informed on this, and this is it's important. Stand up and be counted. Gloria Nafziger, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We've got Kevin on the line. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, Beryl.
How are you?
Good, yourself?
Okay.
Great. In relation to everything that's happening today in the Mideast and what happened this morning, I'm of Lebanese origin, Christian, and I was always pro-Israeli for everything that I've seen over the last couple of years, because they're an established democracy and so forth. But I know they're targeting areas where, unfortunately, the Hezbollah are hiding along with civilians. But the extent and the response, I think it's made me do a complete 360. I'm getting, I guess, baffled by the whole thing, what their real intentions are.
Well, Kev, I understand, you know, that the horrible pictures, but I don't understand, and is what you just said, that it's made you do it. Well, I don't think you made a 360. You mean a 180.
Right.
Israel's response, when it received 1,000 Qassam rockets from Gaza and the city of Sderot was destroyed, basically, it's a ghost town, and was not to attack. They were quiet. They were quiet when the rockets were launched from the north. They finally acted when Hezbollah, not just because Hezbollah kidnapped these soldiers, but because the Lebanese government itself had abdicated the south to Hezbollah. Lahoud himself, President Lahoud himself, had made a deal with Hezbollah and with the Syrians. So did General Aoun. Now, you know, the difference is obviously that you could say, and legitimately, look, Israel shouldn't have gone in with that much air power. When civilians are killed, and as you said, because Hezbollah is hiding among them, it's the exception, not the rule. Hezbollah is using people, Lebanese, as shields, by rule, not exception. So I understand the criticism of Israel's tactics, but Israel has sat patiently and taken pounding after pounding after pounding. 1 million people within Israel are refugees and have been displaced. And is it Israel's fault that they have better bomb shelters and the Lebanese government never had the courage to send in the troops 4 years ago under Resolution 1559?
I mean, I agree that the Lebanese government is at this place responsible for a lot of what's happening, and they should be held to account with making affiliations with the other three parties, but I still think that the numbers are disproportionate.
You know, the Allies killed five times as many German civilians as Germans killed Allied civilians in bombings. It's a numbers game that doesn't make sense, because why didn't the Lebanese protect the Lebanese? But, Kevin, I'm being waved off here. I'm running out of time. Kev, I appreciate your position, and I think the bottom line has to be Lebanon for the Lebanese.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kev. Montreal, we'll be back with you Monday night, and we're going to start a little earlier. We're going to welcome Jim Duff here, but I'll be with him at 6:45, and then we'll go at 7 o'clock. Till then.